The Inside Transportation Podcast is sponsored by Ford Motor Company. Built on the belief that freedom of movement drives human progress from connectivity to autonomy, AI to machine learning, Ford has one simple goal: to improve mobility for its customers. To learn more about Ford's work in mobility, autonomous vehicles, and their corporate efforts to improve mobility for its customers, visit corporate.ford.com. That's corporate.ford.com. The Inside Transportation Podcast is also sponsored by Fenwick & West. Fenwick & West is one of the world's first and leading law firms dedicated to technology and transportation. Learn more about how Fenwick can help companies tackle the complex legal and business issues of autonomous transportation at fenwick.com. That's F-E-N-W-I-C-K.com. Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to the Inside Transportation Podcast, a production of Inside.com. This is our weekly podcast where we discuss transportation trends that you need to know about to stay ahead of the curve. My name is Johan Marino, and I'm the writer of the Inside Transportation and Inside Electric Vehicles newsletters. And I am joined here by my co-host, angel investor, podcaster, Inside.com CEO, Jason Calcanis.
Oh, it's good to be back. And from now on, I want to be like Dave Portnoy. I want to be referred to as El Presidente. I'm going to start day trading. El Presidente del Barstool Sports.
I had no jokes today. I know. I'm sorry, Jason.
No jokes. It's okay. We have a guest today.
We have a very special guest with us today, sitting in, Sunny Madra. Sunny Madra is the vice president of Ford X. His responsibilities include the Ford X subsidiary Autonomic and the Ford X Business Incubator and Accelerator. In this role within Ford Smart Mobility, Sunny ensures Ford is continually discovering and actively incubating new business models. Full disclosure, the Ford Motor Company is a sponsor of this podcast. Without further ado, thanks so much for joining us, Sunny. How's it going?
Oh, great. Great to be here with you guys. Awesome. You know, it's always inspired by the great work that Jason's done with the Launch Incubator. So great to be here and on this chat with you guys.
Yeah, thanks for coming
on. From what I understand is that you and Jason go way back, right?
We do. You know, I think our introductions stretch all the way back to one of the infamous poker games that are held in Silicon Valley. And beyond then, you know, we've run some conferences together, you know, Jason and the fund were an investor in Autonomic. And so it's been a great relationship. And now we're finally doing one of the podcasts together. I'm just honored to be on here with you, Jason.
Yeah, no, it's great fun. And, you know, it's really great here in Silicon Valley because you get to work with somebody over the course of 2, 3, 4 companies. And I've known Sunny, I think now this is his third company or fourth company or fourth act that I know of. And it's great to have big companies, you know, like Ford, you know, really wanting to be part of the dialogue, be part of this podcast and investing in startups and really trying to innovate and being present here. And I know Ford's got a big presence in Silicon Valley, correct?
We do. Yeah. Right in Palo Alto, we have what we call Greenfield Labs. It's like our research and innovation center. And that's where we have a fairly substantial team here, you know, well over 200 people and a lot of research going on in different areas, a lot of productization going on as well. So excited to be in part of the ecosystem with Ford now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's get right into it. What's on the docket for today, Johan?
Yeah, so before we kind of get into the docket, just to kind of give our listeners, you know, just a little more insight about you, Sunny. You're a serial entrepreneur. You're known for starting a lot of awesome companies that have been acquired by major players. How did you end up working for Ford?
Yeah, you know, it was really interesting. When we had sold my previous company, which was called Extreme Labs, it was one of the leading mobile developers in the world, we were acquired by a company called Pivotal, which was a spin out of EMC and VMware. And while we were working with EMC and VMware, the spin out Pivotal, the CEO at the time was a gentleman by the name of Paul Moritz. And if you don't know Paul's background, he was the creator of Windows NT, Microsoft Office. And when he left Microsoft, he got started another company and got bought by VMware and became the CEO of VMware. Legendary in the industry. we were at a sales kickoff, and he was working with, we were talking to a bunch of our automotive customers at Pivotal, and we were talking about the transition from the existing vehicles to connected vehicles. And what, you know, what Paul was helping the automotive OEMs understand was as connected vehicles were going to become more and more prevalent, the need for them to be more interactive into the cloud was going to be important. And so that was a spark of the idea for us. We created Autonomic, and it was a good ride since then. I think Ford had the wonderful foresight to really understand that if they were going to be a leader in connected vehicles, they need to be a leader in the cloud side of the technology, and they acquired the company. And that's how I ended up there.
Yeah, so I know we've long heard this idea about the city of the future, where we can reuse. And this is going to segue perfectly into our first topic, which is talking about COVID-19 and how, you know, some of the transportation trends that we are all familiar with have changed drastically in the matter of like 2 to 3 months. So I guess my first question to you is, what are some of your observations or some of your thoughts as far as shifts that we're going to be seeing in transportation that we're going to see come out of this pandemic? And I'll have a follow-up question for you after that. But yeah, what are some of your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'll just kind of go back into an area where we've been really passionate is micromobility. One of the things that I found really interesting as the pandemic kicked off was a lot of companies were starting to, you know, pull their scooters off the market. But yes, many of the cities that we were working with, they came back to us and really deemed our service essential. So at the time of the peak of the pandemic, you know, we had 8 cities that were really aggressively working with us to keep the scooters on the ground because they represented an essential service, essential transportation for the workers that needed to go to work because all the other systems were shut down. And I think it really shows the power of having some of these distributed systems that exist through like micromobility. So that was one of the changes that I really was surprised by that was going on at that time. But, you know, what are your guys' thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, this is Jason speaking. I don't believe, you know, I'm not a doctor, but New York City getting hit really hard and having been in New York my whole life, it seemed very clear to me that the subway there played some role and the density plays some role in the spread of COVID. We all know that masks are obviously helpful in, you know, keeping the spread down and keeping the virality of the pandemic from, you know, being the R not being over 1 to being under 1. And you know, if you just think about a subway car and how it's designed, it's sealed like a bus, and you have people getting off and getting back on. It's not outdoors. It's underground in the case of New York. So you don't really have any ventilation to speak of, and you have this density. So I have a feeling that, you know, some part of the New York City outbreak, which was the biggest in the country, had to do with the subway. And so it does have me concerned about people coming back to work who rely on public transportation, putting themselves at risk. And then if they don't, well, then they're going to have to take cars into work, and that's going to create gridlock. And so I think it, like, you know, every time there's a crisis like this, there's some things to learn from it. And one of the things I think we have to learn from this is that giving space on the streets for micromobility and really embracing that takes some of the pressure off of the subway and the mass transit systems, which in some cities, the mass transit systems are just completely overburdened with the number of people. I mean, it is packed. And I don't know if you've been on a New York City subway, but I mean, you are within inches of people. You're in during rush hour, your body is touching 2 or 3 other bodies at a minimum, just bouncing around in those cars. It's so crowded. And so there is no doubt that, you know, we're going to need to have more options in cities, not less. And I think it's time to really think about uncapping maybe the number of micromobility options in cities. The argument like, oh my God, there were too many scooters in San Francisco and there were too many on the street. It was a nuisance. When you can't take the subway without, you know, potentially exposing yourself, that doesn't seem like too big of a concern to have too many options, right? And I always felt that when people were complaining.
Yeah, and you know what's ridiculous is in the UK, they had where you know they have a similar issues with public transportation, with the underground, the tube there. You know, they had like a 100-plus-year-old law that didn't allow for motorized vehicles without a driver's license. That was, you know, tied back to some historic laws there. And you can see the type of transformation. They've really they just got rid of that law, and they're going to allow scooters in London now. And that's the kind of change, going back to your question, Johan, is that these cities are realizing that they need these alternative systems. They need the alternative systems that are, you know, in partnership with their public services. And that's, you know, the only way we're going to get through this pandemic right now. And I think it's amazing to see the change that's happening and the support that's coming out of it from all the different cities and the associated entities with them.
I have a question for you, Sunny. Which of the micromobility modalities, formats, do you think wins the day? Because we saw the scooters, and then there were these like scooters with a seat. I don't know what they call those.
They're called wheels, right? I think that's the company behind those.
Yeah, and I think Bird made their own version of it. I know there's many versions of it. And then there's like electric bikes, regular bikes. Which of the micromobility ones do you think will become the standard?
I think it's a great question. Like, you know, I don't know if there's like sort of a one form factor meets all, but I have to say definitely the electric bikes and scooters like are providing the right inspiration. And the one I would say that, you know, we still haven't seen yet, but that's probably like on the horizon, which sort of combines the benefit of scooters, the benefit of electric bikes is sort of the quadricycle. I think, you know, we haven't really seen that yet. And that's the one I think where...
What's a quadricycle?
It's really interesting. It's think of it like an e-bike with four wheels, right? It's something you can sit and you can pedal. It can be covered, so it's much more applicable to use in weather. Exactly. So
these are like the things in Florida retirement homes and stuff like that. They're like you can sit two across or two in front of two kind of situation.
Yeah, so it's really kind of maybe one in front of the other, not two across, because they're narrow enough to go in bike lanes, and that's the beauty of them. And you know, they're I think that's, you know, the direction, if I were to be guessing, where we'll ultimately end up, because there's some real distinct advantages to e-bikes over longer distances. There's some real distinct advantages to scooter on shorter distances, and the quadricycle sort of, you know, bridges those two in the most unique way, which I think is interesting.
Are the quad cycles anywhere, these quadricycles?
They're not. That's the interesting thing, because, you know, I think this is the form factor that, you know, this pandemic, I think, is going to force you to really come through. And we'll see a lot more of them, you know, maybe early next year and beyond, where it just didn't, you know, the scooters were easier to get to. They started all off the shelf in China. And so they came over. This area requires some custom development. And now you're starting to see that from all the major players.
Yeah, the seated, I guess they call them seated electric scooters, are the ones I'm referring to. So it's basically a scooter, but you have a seat, so you can sit.
Yeah, I think Bird calls it a cruiser, right? That's what they call it.
They call it a cruiser, yeah.
It's really cool, because I think the Bird version actually has like a helmet contained within the vehicle. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of innovations we see out of that. But one thing I was going to ask you, Sunny, being that you work closely with the Spin unit, and, you know, we're going to take a break after this, but what are some precautions you have made or changes you've made at the Spin unit to make consumers feel safe about using e-scooters, right? Because I know there's there was a lot of concern about using like these shared surfaces, especially in public, right? Because this scooter's been sitting out there all day. How do you kind of reassure consumers that it's safe to use an e-scooter?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, you know, with Spin in particular, one of the things that we did, because we have a labor force that's out there, you know, either rebalancing the scooters or picking them up for charging. And so we were able to leverage that existing force that's on the ground to adopt in cleaning. And so what we try to do is clean as many of them as we can between uses. And we know that's critical during this time frame. We've also created a lot of awareness for customers. The other interesting thing about a scooter is, you know, we can use it for tracing as well. We know who's used it. We've know know who's been on it as well. There's really interesting aspects that make it powerful. Like coming back to Jason's point on public transportation, it's really hard to understand what's happening. I think one of the things that we can do here with the scooters is better understand who's been on it and use that information for the public good. And so I think there's a lot of things that the scooters have really, and you know, really, really helped with: healthcare workers, essential grocery store workers, hospitals, pharmacies. And that's what was really phenomenal that we saw during the peak of the crisis on how many and what types of people were using them. But you know, those are the high level changes that we made with our with the spin scooters.
Also, I think the consensus is very hard to get coronavirus off of surfaces. Now, again, not a doctor, but people seem to think that us wiping down all of our groceries might have been a bit of overkill because the exposure was so minor, and that you need to have some sustained. And these things are also going to be outside. So if coronavirus does die in the sun, there's that mitigating factor as well. Just speaking from my own point of view, I feel pretty comfortable. I would feel fine jumping on a scooter. I would not feel comfortable riding on a bus or on a subway if people weren't wearing their masks. If they were wearing their masks, I might risk it for a short period of time if it wasn't packed. But I'm curious, just going around the horn here, who would feel comfortable taking a flight in 2020? Has anybody here taken a flight? And do you feel comfortable taking a flight, Johan?
I would take a flight. And I think I briefly mentioned it on last week's podcast. I would take a flight because it looks like, or it appears that the problem is the airport and not the airplane itself. So I've seen that there's some pretty advanced like filtration systems that are actually contained within an airplane. And if everyone's wearing a mask, right, that's the key. And I know some airlines are starting to crack down on this, which is amazing. I think United today said that they would ban passengers for not wearing their masks during a flight, because I know there's a lot of people in this society of ours right now that are being very defiant and they don't want to wear a mask. And I mean, we've seen that that's a big issue. But I think, like, you know, if they're able to, you know, control the airport situation, and like I kind of pitched to you last week, if they created like an outdoor airport or something like that,
yeah, that'd be great.
You wouldn't actually have to be like in a crowded indoor space. I think that would actually be a good solution. But I don't know about you, Sunny. Would you fly this year?
I don't think I'd fly this year. And I, you know, I'm going to just touch on two of the things you said. One, I think there needs to not be just airline policy. I think it needs to be some kind of FAA policy, the same way we're forced to take off our shoes and go through scanners to get on a plane. I think there needs to be just a rule. You can't fly without it. It can't be a airline by airline decision. There needs to be ramifications for doing that. And I don't see that yet today. And obviously there's a lot of differing views on wearing masks, like, which I don't understand why. It's a simple thing to do to help society. And then, you know, on the open airport thing, I think it's fun when it just made me smile. Jason, you're probably familiar with this, but one of my favorite airports in Southern California is the Long Beach Airport.
Oh, amazing.
LBC.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which they, you know, keep building up, but it's, yeah, they, yeah, they keep building these like little sheds next to the baggage claim.
Yeah, that was my inspiration when I started thinking about this idea of an outdoor airport, because I've been through the Long Beach Airport and everything's outside except for like some of the concourses. But, you know, just for background, we'll probably drop something in the show notes. This airport is pretty much completely outside, and it's a lot of fun because you're actually walking on the, you know, the runway where the airplanes are, and it's a lot of fun. Yeah. But before we continue this conversation, we do have to pay the bills. So we're going to take a quick break here on the Inside Transportation podcast, and we'll continue with our guest, Sunny Madra, here on Inside Transportation. Stay tuned.
Hey, everybody. Just want to let you know that this episode of Inside Transportation is sponsored by our friends at the Ford Motor Company, built on the belief that freedom of movement drives human progress from connectivity to autonomy. Ford has one simple goal, and that's to improve the mobility of its customers. Ford has been using technology to shape the future of transportation for over 100 years and is dedicated to solving the world's most pressing mobility issues. What you might not know is that Ford has a series of divisions that make these visions a reality. Ford X is Ford's venture incubator that unites entrepreneurs, designers, and engineers to shape the future of transportation. Ford's City Innovations team brings innovative ideas to life through community workshops, crowdsourcing initiatives, and citywide mobility challenges. And Spin, a property of Ford, brings e-scooter sharing to cities and college campuses. So here's your call to action. To learn more about Ford's work in mobility, autonomous vehicles, and their global efforts to improve mobility for its customers, visit corporate.ford.com. That's corporate.ford.com. Thanks again to Ford for sponsoring independent media like this podcast.
And we're back here on the Inside Transportation Podcast. Jason Calcanis, Johan Marino, with our great guest, Sonny Madra from Ford X. So one question for you, Sonny. We've long heard about this idea of the city of the future, where we can reuse parking space for biking and e-scooters and other forms of micromobility. And also this concept where vehicles will be able to communicate with streetlights and other city infrastructure. How far do you think we are from this envisioned city of the future, if you can offer any insights?
Yeah, you know, and I think you described it really well. There's a lot of different aspects to the city of the future. There's the sort of reframing of the streets to you know, allow for different infrastructure. Interesting enough, you know, we see this in a very early way with the Golden Gate Bridge. I don't know if you've been on it in the last few years, but there's like a truck that drives on it every morning that moves a center divider to create more lanes going, you know, into the city or out of the city. And so it's been a concept that's been around for a long while. I think when it comes to smart infrastructure, we're still a ways off. You know, that's something that it's an interesting concept. It's a very powerful concept, but it's one that doesn't work incredibly well until it's sort of uniform. Because if you think about, you know, the things that have to interact with it, whether it's traditional vehicles or micromobility vehicles, if it's not everywhere from an end user standpoint, you're not going to get the full benefit, because you won't know, you know, having to transition between knowing that the streetlights are smart, you don't have to pay attention, and knowing you have to. I think that's sort of dangerous from a, you know, human-centered design aspect. So I do think we're a ways off there. I think what we're zeroing in on more, going back to where you started, is the repurposing of streets. And so I was just in downtown Palo Alto, and in order, again, tying back a little bit into COVID, but in order to enable restaurants to open, in order for our economy to open, they've closed down California Avenue, and they've allowed it for the restaurants to put their tables out there. And what that's done is it's forced people to rethink how they interact with California Avenue. So instead of you know, bringing your car there because there's less parking now, a lot more people are riding their bikes. And I don't know if you guys have seen some of the pictures on Twitter recently of Walmart sold out of bikes. Like, bike sales, I heard today, the highest since the Second World War. And wow. So you know, I think that's the change that's sort of happening quicker, is the reformatting of the city streets is happening right now. And the smart city movement, it'll continue to happen, and it'll happen in pockets, but that's probably a little bit further out than we anticipated.
So in Palo Alto, they literally closed down California Avenue in Palo Alto?
Yeah, they closed down California Avenue, and all the restaurants have put their, you know, their seating outside. It's actually really, really phenomenal. It feels safe. You can go out there because, you know, with you, sometimes we forget the street has a lot more space than the restaurant does itself. So if you give the restaurant the sidewalk and you give the restaurant the, you know, part of the road, they can easily create, you know, the distancing that they need and have the ability to run the volume that they need to keep their restaurant running. And it encourages people to use these other forms of mobility. It's a really, really nice change. You should try it, Jason.
Yeah, and, no, I've been tweeting about this. It seems like this is one of the great opportunities during this pause for us to rethink cities, because we've been so incrementally adding the bike lanes and the scooter lanes. And it's just, it feels like it's not bold enough. And that if you really want to get people to embrace bicycles, and you want them to sell out or micromobility or not taking their car everywhere, you're going to need to, you know, make some bold move. And we have parklets in San Francisco in the streets, which are just like turning a parking space into a little cafe area, and some slower streets. But I think the bold action is, you know, what I'm super bullish on, because families can go there and then it becomes a bit of a destination. And it just feels like such a huge, huge win for everybody involved.
Yeah, I mean, one question I have for you, Sunny, because I'm sure you've encountered this. Is there any challenges from local governments to kind of redo their streets like this or to implement this smart mobility, you know, infrastructure? Because I've seen some examples in Toronto where I think Alphabet tried to do like a smart city project and it's kind of gone wayside. Do you think there's some reluctance from local governments, you know, about these changes, right? About kind of reformatting the streets for more micromobility. I mean, we all saw that when Bird and Lime came into a lot of these markets, there was a lot of pushback, you know, and nobody really wanted these scooters there. And now they're kind of being like folded into this larger scheme transportation, you know, model that we're all envisioning.
Yeah, I don't think there was reluctance, but I think the amount of change wasn't enough. And, you know, I think you started seeing this in San Francisco, you know, the last couple of years, a lot more bike lanes. But, you know, what this crisis is, again, pushing is not just changing bike lanes, but closing entire streets down. And then when people see the benefit of that, and, you know, they were starting to do this in Europe in many places, a lot of cities, the city centers were closed down now to all vehicle traffic. And what that does is it creates a brand new environment for the shop owners, for the people that are visiting there. And it, and then I think it, you know, there's an initial fear that there'll be less people driving in, but what they realize, the interaction of the people there is far higher, which works out better for the businesses. So I do think not so much resistance in the past, but they didn't want it as much because there was a fear of what the outcome would be. I think what this crisis will show everyone is the outcome will be their business is just that good, if not better. And, you know, there'll be more, I think they'll be sort of more hopeful in continuing to pursue that and keep it aggressive in terms of the rollout of this change that's happening.
Jason, any thoughts?
Well, I'm just curious if you think people want to own scooters or they want to just pick them up on the street corner, because it does seem to me that in order for transportation to become ubiquitous like this, you have to have it be super reliable. And that was one of the things that I know Travis was super focused on in the early days of Uber, was it has to be available. That's why he created surge pricing, ETA. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you needed to be able to get the... It wasn't that you needed to get the car in a minute or two. It just you needed to be able to get a car and know when it was coming. Like those two things. They had to be available, and the estimate had to be accurate. The lower the estimate, the lower the wait time, the better, but it just, you had to know it and be able to see it on the map. And so one of the things I think is hard with people who are fans of micromobility, and we have them in our offices here in San Francisco, is they couldn't reliably get a scooter because there were caps on them here in the city. And, you know, maybe they were all moving from like one train station to, you know, Pack Heights or something, or the Mission. And so they started buying their own so that they could have 100% utilization of it. So is there a way to, I'm just thinking out loud here, for people to own them and also have them as part of the collective, or for people to keep them overnight so they have them in the morning? Has anybody solved that problem?
I don't think it's been solved yet, but the answer to both of those is yes and yes. And the example that I kind of think about in my mind is, you know, for a commute that's very regular for yourself, that you know that there's safety on both ends in terms of, you know, theft or vandalism, you know, what you'll do is you'll take something that you probably likely own over time. Either own directly, or, you know, you lease over long-term periods or rent over long-term periods. And so you bring it in your house, you bring it in your office, and that's probably what you've seen, Jason, right?
Yeah.
I do think the flip side is, you know, if you're going to go meet some friends for happy hour and don't want to be responsible for it, you don't want to take your personally owned $1,000 scooter and leave it outside and then realize you can't, because you're going to take an Uber home at the end of the night. And so I do think we're going to end up in this world where people, you know, are kind of bought into micromobility, but then their use of micromobility will vary. I do that with my own e-bike. I think when there's, you know, if I'm doing something which the bike is with me the whole time, I'm comfortable using my own. But if I'm in San Francisco and I need to get from place A to place B, you know, I'm much more comfortable just taking, you know, one of the bikes that are provided by any of the city providers, because, you know, that responsibility is shifted for me and I don't have to worry about what I have to do next with it. Do I have to bring it home and or anything like that? So I think we're going to see a world where people are using both, and sort of a, you know, rising tide floats all boats in this case. I think when people use that, they'll use more of the use personal shared mobility, they'll use the shared mobility as
what
well.
What about the battery problem? Because that was seemed to be like really ankling some of the services early on. They didn't have purpose-built scooters, so they were, you know, taking that commodity ones. They seemed to break very quickly, but now people are making their own. They're making higher-end ones. I think you guys make your own. And then what's up with the battery life? Because that seems to be another crazy thing that they have to all get picked up and then be charged. Why can't there be like charging stations at regular intervals, you know, and people park them and have some automated charging where any scooter can just go onto, you know, like a dock and just plug in or even be inductive charging? Like, shouldn't that be easy to do, like inductive charging of scooters?
Yeah, so all of those in different shapes and forms are on their way. So I think, you know, first you nailed it. The original set of scooters were all just generally retail commercial scooters, not designed for, you know, fleet use cases. And so, you know, the anticipation by the designer was never that it would be, you know, ridden 20 or 30 miles a day. And so the batteries weren't designed with that. The newer scooters have much bigger batteries. They also have swappable batteries. You know, right now it doesn't make sense to, you know, pick up the whole scooter and put it in a truck and bring it back and charge it. You can just swap a battery out. So I think you're already starting to see those innovations. I think when it comes to the stations, you know, although we love the idea of, you know, having them be dockless, the cities are much more working towards having certain areas where they can be dockless, but other areas where there's greater incentive for them to be docked. And in those docks, you can have these docking stations. Now, those can be powered through wires or they can be wireless, and everyone's working on different forms there. But I think you're going to start seeing those in places. Actually, in Washington, D.C., we have a number of docks that we've had out there, and it actually works out really great for us because it allows us to offer, you know, better pricing. It allows us to keep the clutter down. You know, there's a safety aspect to it as well because you can be locked up in the docks, and so the theft goes way down. So it creates a much greater benefit to the entire community of users using these the devices.
It would be so great if those docks were, if there were businesses who wanted to have foot traffic, and they weren't on a main thoroughfare, but they were on the side street, you know, where there isn't as much foot traffic. You know, I'm thinking like Market Street is a little bit crowded, but any one of those side streets, 5th, 6th, 3rd, whatever, you could have it in front of a restaurant or a Starbucks, a cafe, a bookstore, whatever. And it just gives another reason for people to go there. And maybe they stop in and get a latte or buy a book, whatever it is. It seems like it would be a feature for a lot of landlords. And now that there's going to be a lot of retail space, heck, I bet you could repurpose some of that retail space to be a walk-in and pick up a scooter, right?
Well, you just nailed, I think, the next idea for a launch incubator company. But, you know, think about the effectiveness of an online, you know, ad through Yelp or what, you know, whatever mechanism it is versus an ad where you're a business and you can subsidize the ride to come to your business say, you know, and so not only you have the place that's right close to your business, but you can offer an incentive. You know, what's better, paying for an online ad that you don't really know what the conversion is or paying for someone to come to your place? And, you know, you're giving them the mobility and you're drawing them as a customer to your business.
Yeah. Buy a drink, you buy a beer or a coffee and you get the scooter for free. You know, like that's a really killer idea. It makes me super bullish on like cities being more mobile, you know, and just easier to navigate. It's just too hard to get around some of our cities in America. And this just seems like such a no-brainer.
Yes. And so we're going to take a quick break here on the Inside Transportation podcast. We're talking with Sunny Madra from Ford. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about transportation inequalities. Stay tuned.
Hey, everybody. Let me take a moment to thank Fenwick and West. They're one of the world's first and leading law firms dedicated to technology and life sciences. They operate in the fast lane of innovation where ideas often outpace changes in the law. That's where you find Fenwick's autonomous transportation and shared mobility practice, steering startups, technology giants, and major automotive companies through rapidly evolving legal, business, and regulatory challenges, which we talk about here on Inside Transportation all the time. A Silicon Valley original, Fenwick is a national law firm with offices in Mountain View, San Francisco, Seattle, New York, Santa Monica, and even Shanghai. So here's your call to action. Learn more about how Fenwick can help companies tackle the complex legal and business issues of autonomous transportation at fenwick.com. That's FENWICK.com. Thanks again to Fenwick for providing great legal services to me. I use them personally for our investments. And for supporting independent media like Inside Transportation. Let's get back to this amazing episode.
Welcome back to the Inside Transportation podcast. Jason and I are chatting with Sunny Madra of Ford X. So there's been a lot going on over these past 2 weeks, especially with this conversation around, systematic racism, right? And it really led me to kind of, look deeply at some of the inequalities within the transportation space. And I was hoping we could kind of discuss what are some solutions for these issues. So one thing I wanted to bring up was that people of color are more likely to not have a personal vehicle at home and are more likely to commute to work via public transit. But we've also seen that in New York, for example, Black and Latino riders make up about 86% of fare evasion arrests. And this was from April through June 2019. And I know that the American Society of Civil Engineers has rated America's public transit system a D-. So it's a little bit in shambles. But the other thing I was going to say is that, there's these new solutions like we were kind of discussing, scooter sharing, right? At least one scooter company, Scoot, which is no longer operating in San Francisco, they were accused of redlining a low-income neighborhood last year. And then it's also like, when you, rent a scooter, there's some things that you have to provide. I know, for example, the scooter sharing companies I've used, you have to verify an ID, you have to use a credit card. For some low income areas, they don't have a lot of access to this, right? There's just people who don't have an ID or who don't have a credit card. So I just kind of wanted to open up the floor, and I'll start with you, Jason. What do you think are some of the solutions for us to solve these inequalities with transportation?
Yeah, I come from a place, New York, where, when I was growing up, there was this, the great equalizer was, in fact, the New York City subway system, right? It was equally, it seemed to be equally distributed. Same thing with buses. The issue came into play with cabs and on-demand kind of services. Taxi drivers would not take you to the boroughs, Brooklyn, Queens, Bronx, forget about Staten Island. So literally, when you tried to get in a cab in the city, they would pull up, and if you looked a certain way, they'd say, "Where are you going?" And you'd say, "I'm going to Brooklyn," and they would just drive off, and they wouldn't let you in the cab, or they would say, "It's the end of my shift." So this is actually a real thing. I think is one of the things that Uber really figured out, and Lyft, was we don't give, or they didn't give the destination to the driver specifically to avoid this reason. So the pickup and the destination, like you had to accept the call and you couldn't say, "I'm not going to pick people up from this neighborhood," right? So I think there are things you can do with technology that will just make this super easy because these things are connected. So if somebody doesn't want to put their scooters in a certain neighborhood or they remove them from that neighborhood, all of that is tracked. And so, you should have a way to really enforce, some level of equality in the distribution of these things is my belief. And then really the inequality that I think is really pronounced is the cost of these things. So I really think we need to look at the cost of mass transit and rethink that. Demand-based pricing makes sense to me. I think a lot of this mass transit should be closer to free or free in the off hours so that people utilize it more. So I think one of the problems we have in government is that if anybody were to come up with, crazy ideas, ambitious ideas, innovative ideas, you kind of get destroyed for being risk-taking. And, that's one of the things that the technology companies are good at is taking risk because you don't get fired. It's your company. You can't get fired or it's hard to get fired. And so I think we just have to be a little bit more creative with, solutions.
Any thoughts, Sunny?
Yeah, I completely agree with Jason. There was a study done by the Brookings Institute a couple of years ago that showed, mobility is also tied to your socioeconomic standing, and when that's taken away, it's really challenging. The whole notion of the green cabs in and around New York and the boroughs came out of just that. The yellow cabs wouldn't go to certain places, and so I think what this the current micromobility, we can expand that a little bit into even other areas. But what that really does is I think it does level the playing field. And going back to one of the things that you just asked about, Johan, was We have a program called Spin Access, where you don't need to have a smartphone. You can be unbanked. You don't have to have any income. You can be low income. And we give you a path to utilizing these scooters, because we know that's so important in order for you to get to a place where you can have those things. And so, one, it does take like an active measure by companies supporting that through the other venues. And I think, two, just tying back to what Jason said, you know, we do have to really think about how the overall, you know, when you create these systems and when you create, you know, whatever your models are, your, you know, Jason, you touched on surge pricing, right? You use surge pricing, not just to, you know, drive utilization, which I think is the most important, but also use it to drive value to those folks or resources to those folks that don't have it. And I think that's sort of the distribution that, you know, public institutions have a harder time doing, and private companies can do a better job with. And, you know, you saw that even in the pricing with between the cabs, as Jason was talking about. So I do think these private companies coming in these spaces are going to have a lot more influence on helping those folks that need access to transportation through the different modes that are becoming available.
And do you think that will be achieved by having private companies partner with public transit companies? Does it come down to having Uber and having Lyft and, you know, even having Spin partner with public transit agencies to kind of level that playing field?
I think that's one aspect of it. And I do think that, you know, it's the variety of offerings that are needed as well. I think when it narrows down into, you know, going back to like, think about New York City, when your only options are the bus or subway, that's what gets you limited, right? But if there's more options available, and it's even better if those options can be cross-pollinated, like you're suggesting. But I think that's what we just haven't had in society. Like, think about, until this micromobility thing came around a few years ago, your options were a bus, you know, subway, or, you know, owning a car, or Uber or Lyft. Now we've
walking.
Really expanded that. Walking, yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
think exactly. About that. I mean, when I lived in Los Angeles as well, and there was, you know, very limited service, especially to places like Bel Air, Brentwood, Beverly Hills, and there would be just a lot of domestic workers walking up and down these incredibly long hills to do that last mile, right? And it was notable, and it's definitely something that people need to think about, is that last mile. And the arduousness of a long commute is just brutal on people's personal lives. And so they've correlated the length of your commute with depression, domestic violence, alcohol abuse, just any number of just soul-crushing impact of having a two-hour commute, a three-hour commute. So part of this is also housing and having housing options in cities that are more affordable. And I think this pandemic is having a number of people decide, especially keyboard jockeys, you know, people who work behind keyboards, are moving out because they can. And what I hope is that as we reconfigure cities, maybe that takes a little pressure off, rents come down a little bit, and maybe people can move closer to the cities who work in cities, like firefighters, teachers, cops, whatever. It'd be great if they could live in the communities where they are. And that's another thing society could look at, is subsidizing, you know, housing and getting people just a little closer to the areas they actually work. It's been
totally
a major major problem for, you know, the Bay Area, where teachers, the public school, just all the school systems up and down the peninsula, it's gotten so expensive here that living, you know, teaching in Palo Alto or you know, the Burlingame, San Mateo area where I live, or even in the city, it's just so hard for people to get there. Teachers were having to commute 90 minutes to teach, you know, and they're exhausted when they get to school. That's something to definitely consider.
I mean, I think one of the potential solutions there, and I think we've actually discussed it on this podcast, is with autonomy, right? Because when you're driving an autonomous vehicle, you can do other stuff. You don't have to drive while you're in your car. You can take a nap, you can work, you can, you know, do many things. And I think with this pandemic, we're starting to see more people see like a personal vehicle as more than just a form of transportation, but actually like a form of lodging. This is going to be really creepy, Sonny, but I saw that you actually just invested in a van life vacation startup, Cabana. I don't know if you want to discuss that a little bit more, or, you know, give us some insight behind your investment in that company.
Yeah, you know, you nailed it, right? I think what we're going to see is this shift where, you know, electrification of vehicles is really opening up the larger realm of possibilities. I think what we're going to start seeing is people can think of, you know, the van life movement can really be expanded. You know, prior to electrification, you had to burn some type of fossil fuel to heat yourself or cool yourself or give yourself power. With electrification, that fundamentally changes. And I think it's not, and going back to kind of Jason's point, it's not out of reason to have a really nice vehicle that you can maybe live in during the city in the weekdays and have a nicer place outside the city. I'm not saying that's the end-all, be-all solution. And on the flip side, you know, if you think about the surge that happens in cities once in a while, like a big Salesforce conference or something like that, where, you know, we have all this infrastructure built for these events that happen sort of somewhat infrequently, but if that could be repurposed to something else for people that actually live there, and the surge can be handled by, you know, some kind of mobile, you know, solution, think about the benefit that that does. We can take so much hotel housing and all that, and even Airbnb housing, and shift it to for workers that need to be there, that live there, that service us, that make, you know, that need to live their lives. And so I think the opportunities that are coming with this van life movement are phenomenal. I'm a really, really big fan of it personally.
This is Cabana you're investing in?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. It's a great company. And they're using Ford Transits, right? Which is your platform company or your platform vehicle for workers?
That is our platform for, yeah, commercial vehicles. Yeah, correct.
So they take those, and those are super cheap, right? What do those go for, 30 grand or something, 40 grand?
I think they start in the 30s, and you know, you can soup them up to much bigger prices, but I think they start in the 30s, number one selling commercial vehicle, so it's great.
What's great about those is, you know, you like you're saying, there's a lot of land available, there's a lot of campgrounds available, there's a lot of parking lots available, and so when there is a surge for an event, whether it's Coachella or a Super Bowl, you know, people are going to get creative with housing, and this is a great way to get creative with housing. And we see this already. There were professors at Stanford, I understand, or other colleges who were living in RVs in the Bay Area and living, you know, maybe, you know, 2 or 3 hours away, you know, maybe St. Louis Obispo or something or somewhere far away. And they would come up and teach for 2 or 3 days at Stanford, live in a RV for those 2 or 3 days, and then head back home for the 4-day weekend. That's one of my things that I think comes out of this pandemic, is that we're going to move to a hybrid model where you work for 3 days at your company and then you work from home for 2 days and you have 2 days off. It's going to be something like that, I think, will become some new standard.
I agree with you. I think we're already starting to see the shifts of that. And I think in order to adapt, we'll need these type of solutions to go alongside that. Because where are you going to stay for those 3 days? Because, you know, you may live outside of the city by 3 hours, 4 hours, whatever it happens to be. So I think these type of mobile and portable solutions are going to be more and more needed by folks as well.
Hey, I got a question for you about Ford. My first car, you know, Sonny, was a Ford Mustang 1973 Grande with the 351 Cleveland 4-barrel carburetor.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Such a nice car. You have an electric Mustang coming out in 2021. Is that still on track?
It is. Yep, it's on track.
And so tell us about that car. Did I read correctly? It's going to have a 300-mile electric battery?
Or something in that range? Something in that range. I'm not sure we've exactly put the final numbers out, but I think we've said something in that range, yeah.
And it's going to cost 50 grand or something? It's going to be Model 3 level pricing?
I think it's even lower than a Model 3 in some configurations, yeah.
And so I'm curious, how does Ford look at a company like Tesla and the competition with them?
Look, I think what Tesla's done for the entire industry, like we can never thank Elon enough, right? Because I think he's one, done something that's a great benefit to the world and a push for electrification. You know, Bill Ford has been an environmentalist as long as he's been involved with the entire company. So I think it's for the industry, he's done something phenomenal. I think, beyond that, what he's doing is he's pushing all the companies to improve vehicles. Like, I think at the end of the day, there's this like pitting that happens, and that's not really it. I think he's just creating good standards for the rest of the industry to come after.
Yeah.
And say, like, more distance on vehicles, more vehicle safety through autonomous-like features, more features within the vehicle, whether it's larger screens, whether it's connectivity, whether it's biohazard mode, right? Whether it's ability to leave your pets in the vehicle. These are all things that the entire industry will innovate and make, and even some of those things tie back to some of these van life ideas. So when I think of Elon, when the company thinks of him, I think it's phenomenal what he's done for the industry.
Yeah. And this car comes out next year. And then how does the truck business work? I know you and I have talked about this amazing truck business Ford has. And then there was this company, what is it called? Nikola, that went public. We talked about last week. And they've never delivered a car, but the company is worth $30
billion. Hydrogen-powered cars, yes.
I don't know exactly what happened with that, but I'm curious what we think of electric. Do you think electric is what pickup drivers want? Or do you think it's going to be a new category of people or unknown?
It's probably a new category of people in addition to what's already there. I think... there's some physics issues. Like if you're towing, and you've experienced this in your own car, Jason, right? If you have your Tesla and you have all the features on, air conditioning, heated seats and all that, your distance comes down, right? Imagine the penalty that towing creates. And so I do think there's a category of people that would love to have electric. And, we've committed to putting an electric F-150 out there as well. But I also think there's an existing category that use these vehicles in ways that the electric physics problem hasn't solved yet. And so if you were to ask me, I think the overall market will grow with electrification, which will be great. And, there'll be a lot of different solutions there for people, some coming from Ford, others coming from other companies as well.
I'm interested about is Hertz. Like, what do we all think about the market for rental cars? I told you my Hertz horror story the other day, John, last week, of just how it's like super frustrating. And I did like that. I used a silver car once. I did like that experience. I'm curious if you think long-term, Sonny, there is going to be a rental car market, or does that go away with ride-sharing, autonomy, et cetera?
It's so interesting because... I think if you would have thought about it a few months ago before the crisis, I think it would have been hard to see where the rental car market plays. I think just tying back to that conversation we just had a few minutes ago, with sort of changing behaviors, maybe the rental car market, if it can shift itself to being not so focused on such short-term rentals, that could be powerful for folks. I think if they can really adapt to the changing consumer behavior that's happening, I do think they have a long-term opportunity.
And is it to rent to like Uber and Lyft drivers is the opportunity, or just short, like midterm rentals, like 30-day, 60-day rentals? Is that what you're thinking?
Well, they could expand maybe even simpler, right? Like, let's go back to that example. Let's just say we go to this, working from the office 2 days a week, but I live 70 to 200 miles from the home, from the office. And now I only need one car at home for our everyday use, but I need a second car that day. It's not feasible for me. Maybe the public transportation doesn't get me there. Maybe long distance transportation's not set up enough for me to get me there. Uber and Lyft is not feasible. So I'll need to rent a car for that day for that longer drive. And I think if they adapt to those scenarios, there could be an opportunity for them.
Perfect. Why is there such a big debate, Sonny, between when level four autonomy, like driving while you're asleep, being driven somewhere while you're sleeping, no steering wheel in the car. It seems like there's a group of people who thinks this is like happening in the short term, and then there's a group of people who think it's 10, 20 years out, right? Bill Gurley talks about it, thinks it's 10, 20 years out. Obviously, he's an investor in Uber, famously. But when do you think that actually will exist in a major city somewhere in the world, that you'll get into a car and be able to go to sleep and not even touch the steering wheel, point to point?
Yeah. I think the misconception is, like, when people think about it, they think it's going to be this like step function. And, you know, we all know in consumer adoption, it's not. Like, look how long, you know, smartphones were around in some way, shape or form before they really took off. You know, the iPhone and Androids weren't the first ones there, right? There was plenty of BlackBerries and Palm Treos, and we all had those, right, Jason?
Yeah.
So
Sidekick.
I think exactly, right? So I think there's going to be this curve, and I think the initial part of the curve is going to be sort of more fixed and well-known routes that are, you know, properly mapped. And I think the vehicle technology is getting there. I think when you think of, well, I can, you know, push a button and get in my car in Palo Alto and say, take me to LA, and it all happens and I can fall asleep in the back, that's probably a bit further out. And
yeah.
I think when you think of that spectrum of use cases, that's where people get stuck, especially if you think of there's going to be a step function to get you kind of from A to B.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean,
go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I use in my Model 3, I use the, you know, autopilot, you know, basically daily. It works fine on the 280. If on a winding road in, you know, anywhere else in the peninsula, I would not engage it right now without being super vigilant, because the roads are just not clearly labeled, marked in all cases. And it just feels like the technology is really good on highways. And, you know, maybe the highway feels like 90% of the way there in my mind, maybe even 95%. But the roads and streets in the city, man, that feels like no more than 50% of the way there. I would even, maybe even less. It feels like that's going to be the hard one, right?
I think so. And it goes back to the earlier discussion around smart infrastructure. Right now, you have to account for, like, the highway can be safe until the lane markings go away or something like that. And, you know, there was some really, you know, tragic accidents that happened on the 101 with the, you know, the vehicles in these auto drive modes because the lane markings were changing. I think, you know, what we'll see is as soon as there's smart infrastructure adapted to it so that the vehicles aren't fully relying on their cameras and sensors, that the infrastructure can tell them about changes or other vehicles that they're communicating what's happening further up the road, I think we'll see the safety go up quite a bit as well.
Great. Yeah, that technology coming to, like, for the different cars to communicate with each other like airplanes do?
That is starting to come. You know, there's a couple of big movements like the V2X movements that are out there that a lot of manufacturers have committed themselves to make that available in terms of vehicle-to-vehicle communication, because it really does make some of the problems that are trying to be solved a lot safer for the end user, right? The example with cameras that I always kind of talk about, Jason, is like, think about your eyes as a human, right? If you're driving down the 280 at the, you know, I'll say the wrong time of day, the sun is directly in your eyes. Well, that's the same sun that goes in the camera's eyes, right? And so
Right. The
camera sensors. So and there's no way around that. That's just a problem. And so you need other sensors to then offset what's happening with the sun. And so, you know, when you're feeling that comfort level, you have to really understand that there has to be other things that the vehicle then use to figure out what's actually happening on the road.
As we saw with that, a Tesla self-driving went right into the side of an overturned tractor trailer. I don't know if you saw that video where it just went right into the side of it because it was a big white one. And I think the cameras don't see it. And stationary objects are not an easy thing for self-driving to avoid, right? Because it doesn't want to slam on the brakes on the 280, right? Or whatever highway you're on.
Yeah. I'm not an expert in those systems, but I would say that. Yeah. That's probably what happens there.
Yeah. It's a
Perfect.
Really challenging issue.
Kind of wrapping things up, last question of the podcast today, and we've been with Sunny Madra.
Sunny Madra Johan.
Sorry,
just think
we
Sunny
had another
Day.
Guest
Sunny
named
Day.
Named Sunny Monroe, so I had it.
We had
like,
Sunny Monroe on. Yes, he
yes,
rips cars
yes.
apart.
No, the one question I was going to ask you guys, and this can be anything in the transportation space. It can be electric vehicles. It can be ride sharing. Whatever it is, right? What innovation in the transportation space have you seen recently that is really exciting you? And we can start with Jason. J-Dog, you go first.
J-Cal, let me think that through. Things that I find super exciting. You know, I have to go with VTOLs because I have a feel, you know, I love the promise of a helicopter. I love the promise and the concept of a helicopter, but I refuse to fly in them. I've flown in helicopters twice in my life. Once I flew in the Sony private helicopter after landing on the Sony private jet in Teterboro with Mickey Schulhoff back in the day. And we took this corporate helicopter from Teterboro in New Jersey to the east side of Manhattan in like, you know, minutes. And it was phenomenal, but terrifying for me. And then I did one of these doors off helicopters going up the coast of Kauai to the Nepali coast, I guess. And that was incredible, but also terrorizing with no doors on it and the crazy, you know, helicopter pilot who literally was a Vietnam helicopter pilot. I kid you not. And, you know, he just loved to tilt the helicopter and let you hang out the side of it. And I guess there's people doing this. There's literally a helicopter hang out the side thing you can do in Manhattan. I don't know if they've stopped people from doing it, but a bunch of like internet, you know, influencers were doing it and hanging their feet out the side. But VTOLs, oh my Lord, if you could get in a VTOL, you know, in any city on a bay, i.e. Manhattan, Brooklyn, Staten Island, San Francisco, Sydney, Australia, anybody with bodies of water, I think are going to be the early candidates. And instead of ferry service, we're going to have VTOL service. And if these things have 8 or 12 of those rotors on them and one or two go out, they can still rebalance themselves. So I have a feeling the promise of those things is they might be so much safer than helicopters eventually that you would feel safer in those than any mode of transportation. And they might be able to land on people's tennis courts eventually or, you know, in people's backyards if they have a big backyard. And it could be just a crazy, wonderful game changer. I know people think about, they make a little bit of noise, but I've been watching this company in China that's been doing a bunch of test flights with humans in them at times. And it does see, I don't know how long those are away, but I got to think in 5 or 10 years, you'll be able to take one of those rides in an experimental form in Hong Kong or something.
Yeah, I think our friend Sky, Jason, is involved with Joby.
Yes, Kitty Hawk, maybe?
Joby. I think
Joby. Joby's the other one.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
How far off do you think those are?
Yeah, I just don't know enough about that space. Yeah. I'm not really like an aviation, you know.
But like if you had to take a guess on like startup culture, like of when you'd be able to fly in one experimentally, not like fly it into your backyard, but you could go on an experimental flight. They felt safe enough to let people pay $100 to take one across the bay over
5 to 10 years.
Okay.
10 years.
Wow. That's what I would have set the line at
this
7.
Decade.
Yeah,
this decade.
For sure this decade. They promised us flying cars. And we're going to get a flying car. Which one is yours? Which is Johan's original question. What is the thing that most inspires you?
So alongside VTOLs, which you know you already talked through, I actually like the idea of my vehicle being able to do errands and chores for me.
Wow.
And so you know, I think about this current environment, and I don't know what your experience has been, guys, but like, you know, for me, it's been a shift away from Amazon. And, you know, the companies that have really come through for me during this crisis have been like, you know, the Walmarts and Targets of the world and the local stores because, you know, sort of maybe there was a rush on Amazon or whatever it was. And, you know, it's probably worth dissecting in a separate conversation. But what I would love is, you know, pickup and delivery has just been, I don't know if you guys have used it during this crisis, but those companies do a really good job now. And they make it really straightforward and simple. And now I think, okay, because they've done that, I don't really need to be in the car. And that's a low speed route. It's kind of really ideal for autonomy. And so, you know, I'd love to get in my car, push a button and say, hey, I ordered something at the local Home Depot, Target, Walmart, you name the business. Go pick it up for me. They already know how to do that now with all the back and forth.
So they just see your license plate. The trunk opens. They throw the boxes in the trunk.
Yep.
And it comes home. So brilliant. Yeah. What is the best pickup experience you've had to date? Like, do you have to get out of the car or do they just know your license plate or do you just text them your number or say your number? How does it work?
The best experience is Home Depot. So you pull up to a Home Depot and when you pull up to a slot, there's like a number you text and like a slot number. And basically nothing else is required. The person shows up, you pop your trunk, they put in your goods and you're off. You're off.
Whoa.
Is that like the standard at Home Depot? I want to go shopping just to have that.
You should do it. And what you'll also find, Jason, the price of something at Home Depot, I'd be willing to say more than half the time is cheaper than it is on Amazon.
That makes total sense to me. And I drive by a Home Depot every time on the peninsula on the way home. I think it's in San Bruno or something. And I did stop there once to get flowers or something or plants or earth or whatever. But the great part about it is to not have to go into the store and wait online. just to have, like, if you're like, literally when I went, I was picking up like 4 or 5 bags of soil. I had to go in, I had to get a card, I had to get it scanned, I had to lift it up to find the barcode. You just drive up and have it dumped into your trunk, and I could put like a towel down in the trunk before that. What a great vision. I love that.
You can do this now. You should try it. You should give it a try.
I'm going to do it, No, but I love yours. Yeah. It's just like your car just drives there, pops the trunk, puts it in there.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just a great... And what do you think of those little like R2-D2 robots? Are those actually going to work? Those slow-moving burrito delivering R2-D2s?
Yeah, I think those are great. You know, it's just sort of... The time and space. I think, you know, if you're living in a dense environment, it makes a ton of sense. You know, you shouldn't use a 4,000-pound car to deliver a half-pound pizza unless, you know, especially if it's only got to go like 1 mile, like those robots make sense. But, you know, on the flip side, if you've got to get, you know, 4 bags of dirt or 8 bags of dirt from Home Depot to your house in Palo Alto, that's not going to happen on one of those R2-D2 robots, right? And so I do think there's a world where you need kind of both of these things, just depending on the use case that you need it for.
Awesome. Hey, Johan, great job. Sunny, great job.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much, Sunny, for joining us. That was Sunny Madra of Ford X sitting
Good
here
job.
With Jason Calcanis, Johan Marino. This was the Inside Transportation Podcast. Big thanks to Ford Motor Company for sponsoring this podcast. And we will see you all next week. Take care.